Hello, I'm Paul Scott, and today I'm talking to Tom Burnett, the CEO of Accesso, ticker ACSO. Quick disclaimers, I'm not giving any recommendations or financial advice. I do hold shares in the company, and I'm not charging a fee. All questions have been submitted by readers of my blog and bulletin board readers. So hi, Tom, and welcome.
Hi, good afternoon.
Okay, so let's kick off by asking you to just give an overview of the business for people not familiar with it.
Sure, by all means. So Accesso is a AIM-listed technology company. We've got a market capitalization now of about £220, £225 million, and 80% free float, and we're held by lots of fund managers, both in London and elsewhere around Europe, and about a 15% retail hold. And we see our purpose in life is to help owners of attractions, and we use the word attraction in a very broad definition. You know, basically, you know, our customers are places where you and your family or your friends might go at the weekend or during the holidays to have a nice time. So it could be a theme park or a wax museum or a ski resort or a museum or, you know, a place you might go out and have a nice time. And we see our job is to develop, you know, great technology which helps these attractions engage with their customers as in the best possible ways that they can, and importantly for the attraction operator, drive as much revenue as possible. And we try and think of commercial models that then allow us to sort of participate in the revenue that we help create. And something like 90% or so of our revenue is derived from some kind of transactional revenue model, where if we help sell something, we might take a share of the value of the items that we sell, or we might run some technology where we, you know, can charge for using the technology, and we might take a share of the profits, or so on. We do that in about 1,000 venues in currently, I think, 25 countries or thereabouts, and we've been growing, you know, pretty well over the last few years. And for those of you that, you know, have been following the story for a while, you know, we started off life as a company called LoQ, with the ticker LoQ, which I'm sure some of the listeners will remember. And rather confusingly, I'm afraid we changed the name to Accesso about 3 years ago, largely because I think it's a better name.
Yeah, okay. And you've broadened the product range, haven't you? So it's things like queuing systems, and could you outline the main product lines, perhaps?
Yeah, by all means. So we have four product divisions in the business, although we think about ourselves as being one company, really, rather than, you know, in separate divisions. But if I perhaps kind of abstract the idea up a little bit before talking about exactly what we do, we think about life in terms of what we describe as the digital guest journey. So I'd like you just to think for a minute about the things that you as a consumer of a place you might go and hang out with your friends at the weekend, if you think about the things you might do before, during, and after your visit. So you'd probably go online, I suspect, these days, and you'd do a bit of research and you'd understand the proposition. And, you know, ideally, as far as the operator is concerned, you would make a decision to attend, and you would purchase and commit. And then, of course, you'll turn up and you'll do whatever it is that you're going to do. And, you know, ideally, again, as far as the operator is concerned, you'll share some of that experience with your friends, maybe on social media. You'll have a nice time. You'll spend money. And then, you know, clearly post your visit, you know, it may be that you want to go back, or you want to go to other attractions run by the same operator or what have you. And we think about how technology can support that journey. And so we started LoQ, as I described a minute ago. LoQ was a business which centered around the idea of virtually rather than really queuing. So broadly using some technology to help you not stand in a physical queue line at the theme park, but to queue virtually. So, you know, you could be queuing while you're having lunch, or whilst you're playing your game, or whilst you're maybe even riding another ride. And that was the business that I was hired to come in and run, whatever it was, in October 10, 2010. Mm-hmm. And I was very happily at the time given sort of pretty much free rein to, you know, do what I thought was the right thing for the company. And I think when I looked at the market we operated in, and at that time, it was pretty much only theme parks. And at that time, really, we just had one customer, which is a big American a big American theme park operator called Six Flags, and we had, I think, 15 or 16 venues we served then. Anyway, I was really struck by, frankly, the immaturity of the supply chain serving the global industry. And, you know, that really hit home when I went to the first big trade show. So once a year, the whole of that industry gathers in Orlando for a huge trade show at the end of the season. And I went off to Orlando just a few weeks after I joined the company and walked into this enormous great shed in Orlando. Something that makes, you know, sort of the Excel Center in London look like your garage, you know, a really big building full of vendors. You know, like, I mean, thousands of vendors. And they were all really small. And I mean, apart from a few ride manufacturers, there was nobody that really stood out. Now, I came from the defense business. And in the defense business, you know, you have a very structured tiered supply chain. So you've got the big old giants of the BAEs and the Lockheeds and the Northrops at the top end, you know, coming down through the tiers of supply chain into companies like Kinetic and Serco and all the way down into sort of university spin-out territory. And I looked at the attractions industry, and I couldn't see that at all. And I thought, well, crikey, that seems like an odd thing, because we have some quite big companies in the industry, you know, companies like Merlin, obviously known to lots of people in this country, and many others like it around the world. And, you know, I couldn't see how they were getting really kind of good value out of their supply chain. Where were the people that could help support them, around the world? And frankly, I couldn't see any others. So I thought, okay, that's what we'll do. We'll build a company that can do that. So back to my idea of the digital guest journey. And the first company we bought was a company called Accesso, which is the one that I changed the name into. And if you think about the digital guest journey, the only thing that everybody has to have is a ticket. And other than that, you know, pretty much most things are optional. You don't have to buy a Coke. You don't have to play a game. You don't have to, you know, think about the photography package, but you do probably have to have a ticket. Yeah. And when I looked at the market, there were a number of ticketing businesses out there, but there was only one which I thought was any good, frankly, and that was called Accesso. So I phoned the fellow up that set it up, the founder, who is now a great pal of ours, and you know, he is the COO of our business, and an outstanding fellow, a guy called Steve Brown, who had in a previous life done ticketing at Disney and then gone on to do ticketing at Six Flags. And anyway, he had this fantastic little business which was serving tickets, or was a white label ticketing vendor serving, you know, I think at the time maybe 100 venues, but it had a couple of big clients, Six Flags and Cedar Fair, who are another American theme park operator. And he saw, or he shared with me, my vision that actually with scale, if you could build a supplier of scale, then you could address, you know, a really global market. And you could become a real long-term partner rather than just a supplier of bits and bytes and a CD with some software. Right? You could become a partner to the industry and really help them drive value. And, you know, if you got to a scale where, you know, you had, you know, the money to invest properly in what you were doing and you could, you know, afford to spend millions of dollars getting ready to serve a client, and you could afford to set up offices around the world to look after them, you know, and which was a pipe dream when we were having this conversation 4 years ago. But we felt that if we could get ourselves to that stage, you know, there was something really exciting available to us in terms of the market. So anyway, we did a deal. And we then, a year later, exactly, did another deal. We bought a company called Siriusware, which had started life in the ski industry. It now has more non-ski clients than ski clients. But to give you an idea, I think we have about 180, kind of off the top of my head there, but about 180 ski resort clients in North America. And what Siriusware does is a North American ski resort differs considerably from a European ski resort. And by that, I mean a North American ski resort, basically what's happened is a development company have bought a mountain and they've built a ski resort. And they own all the commercial assets across the mountain. So all the bars and the restaurants and the ski hire and the retail stores and the ski lifts and the season parties, you know, all of that is controlled and owned by Mammoth or whoever it is. And they had built a brilliant solution to that issue of having these, you know, different commercial models, different commercial assets, all running points of sale and inventory management and all the the back office you need to run those kind of operations that all talk to each other and link together in a way that you could track a guest as they moved around your as you moved around your ski resort, and you could have a single, as the CFO of the resort, you could have a single eye view of what was going on across your business. And of course, if you kind of think laterally, you can see that a theme park has exactly the same series of challenges. It's got a bunch of different types of commercial assets, from restaurants to retail stores to buggy works, stroller rentals, to a whole range of different commercial things going on, all under common ownership. A museum's the same. You go into a big museum and there's somebody trying to sell you a ticket at the front gate, and then there's a restaurant trying to sell you lunch, and there's a store selling you souvenirs and fridge magnets. Exactly the same challenge. So we bought Seriousware, we plugged it into our e-commerce solution, Passport, which came with Accesso, and we started growing that business fairly rapidly. And then the final business we bought was a company called Showware. And Showware is another ticketing company, but this time it's rather than a general admission ticketing platform, so the business that Steve started, Accesso, and the Passport platform, is what we would describe as a general admission ticketing platform. So that means it takes you to the front gate of an attraction where you go through a turnstile or you get scanned in or somehow you enter and then you can go and play. So think about a zoo or a ski resort or a theme park or a water park as good examples of general admission attractions. Museum would be the same. Whereas an assigned seat attraction is where we put you on a seat to watch a performance of something. So you might be going to a cheering concert, or you might be going to the theatre, or you might be going to the sports match, or anything in between, a comedy show, you name it. But it takes you to a theatre or a stadia or somewhere where your bum goes on a seat. And that's what Showware does. And we finished that acquisition another year later. So we did three acquisitions in almost exactly 3 years, or on the anniversary of each other, so over 2 years. And we spent the last year without doing any more acquisition, although there will be more in our future, I'm sure. But we spent the last year, just kind of taking stock, putting the business together, integrating it deeply, making sure all the software talks to each other as it needs to talk to each other, and actually just, thinking about the kind of business that we're going to be. For the first time, we have one global sales team. We have, one global sales and marketing budget. We have, one CTO thinking about the global technology strategy, just efficiencies that come with scale. And what's been lovely to see just in the last little while is we're now sort of 325, 340, of that order of people, and we're growing so fast, which is why I'm kind of unsure of the number. If you're part of a business which is, has some scale and we're serving 1,000 venues in 25 countries, and there's not many doing that, I can tell you. In fact, I think we're probably the only one. You walk a bit taller, and you stand a bit prouder, and you have, I hope without being arrogant in any way, but you have, you can speak with a bit more authority when you go and speak to a client. And also, you just have the scale behind you to know that your company can keep your promises. And we're really just beginning to see that change in the way that we collectively are performing and behaving. And that's incredibly exciting to feel us kind of grow into being the slightly bigger company that we've been able to create. And also to see how the market's reacted to that. And I'm sure we'll come onto it in questions, but just in the last 6 months, if I was looking for demonstration of this strategy coming to life and being successful, we've had two, colossal kind of vindications of that strategy in the last few months. The first one was our friends and colleagues at Merlin, who clearly a fantastic British success story, 100 and plus attractions in 22 countries around the world. They spent quite a while getting to know us, looking at what our products did, taking some judgments on, how they wanted to, deliver ticketing across their global estate. And we were delighted last summer when we were able to conclude a deal which has us as their exclusive global ticketing provider across their entire estate. And you know, we're well into the rolling out of that of that project now, of that contract now, and that's a 7-year engagement. And then perhaps even more, you know, fantastically, if from our perspective at least, is that our biggest customer is Six Flags, where we have a big queuing business and we have a big ticketing business, big e-commerce business for them. And, you know, we just renewed our arrangements with Six Flags for another 10 years,
wow.
Which is, you know, pretty unprecedented, I think, to be able to look at 10 years. And, you know, what that does, you know, so back to our commercial model that I was explaining a little earlier on, you know, we tend to charge a percentage of revenue of goods and services that we sell online, or maybe a profit share of a queuing solution that we've installed, or whatever it might be. But we would say that we have very high visibility of repeatable revenue. So whilst we have contracts in place with our customers that don't necessarily guarantee us revenue, we have contract vehicles in place which, you know, assuming people turn up at theme parks or turn up to the theater or turn up to wherever they're going, you know, we're very, very sure that the revenue that we had last year is revenue that we'll be able to achieve this year or even grow based on our interjections and our improving of the software and changing customer behavior as people are more comfortable buying phones and all of that sort of moving parts. And, you know, so I think our top 5 clients alone who represent maybe 200 or maybe even a little less of our 1,000 venues, we can project forward the contracted business we have with those 5 clients. This doesn't involve us extending any contracts we already have. And we can see, we think, somewhere between 60 and 70% of our 2022 revenue number already,
wow.
Just from those top 5 clients.
Gosh.
Which is a pretty startling thing. You know, clearly
it
that
is.
Underpinned significantly by Merlin and by Six Flags. But, you know, we renewed another very big customer, Cedar Fair. We renewed for 3 years earlier on last year, so a bit less than a year ago, I think, now. And actually, the reality is that clearly we have more than 200 customers. And we're very, very sticky, it turns out. So I thought I understood a thing or two about customer service before I started working in this industry. And then I started working with a bunch of people that, you know, had been trained and spent large parts of their life working at Disney.
Mm.
And it turns out that I can barely spell customer service, let alone know how to deliver it. And let me tell you, customer service, if you're doing it properly as a supplier, your first reaction, or my first reaction at least, was, blinking heck, that looks expensive. It looks like, we have no, what's the right way to put this? We are, we would bend over backwards for our clients.
Mm.
You know, if people, we would not hesitate ever to get on a plane and go and see them any reason. And we certainly wouldn't ever send them a bill, you know, ever. We would absolutely, our business model absolutely relies on us delivering fabulous customer service to our customers, because, you know, we don't get paid unless they're selling stuff or doing good things for their customers. And we will absolutely go out of our way to look after our customers. And that, combined with great software, and, you know, this last year, I think we spent $12 million on product development. I think my next biggest attraction ticketing competitor might turn over $15 or $16 million, to give you an idea of relative scale.
Yeah.
So where we sit against our competition. You know, if you're spending a lot of money on good product and you're servicing your clients just as deeply as you possibly can, and you're not ripping them off with your commercial model, then, you know, why would they leave? Or at least that's how my little brain thinks about it. You know, why would they go anywhere? And,
well, that's,
you know,
why I like why I like your shares so much. You know, I'm not going to pretend I'm impartial. I'm not. I'm a keen shareholder. Because you've got such a great moat around your business, haven't you?
Mm, absolutely. So, you know, the fact is that we don't lose customers. You know, Sirius, 25-year-old business, it still has its first customer. Across the whole of our business, we have something like a 98% customer renewal rate.
Mm.
It's phenomenal.
Fantastic.
People don't go. So broadly, every time we win a piece of business, you know, we're just layering in another opportunity to create value for ourselves and for our customer, and of course all our stakeholders, so our shareholders, you know, going forward. And you know, we lose customers when, you know, sadly, occasionally some of them go bankrupt because they've overextended or, you know, stuff happens. Sometimes they'll get bought and they'll be absorbed into something else which has got a, you know, a different view around a technology, you know, direction. But by and large, we don't lose customers, and it's a ferocious thing. I'm not sure if I'm going to get any ahead of the questions for you, Paul, but it becomes a point when you tip into, and this is really interesting because it's happening to us now, when you tip into a position of market leadership. And I'm not necessarily talking about our queuing business here. You know, we have fantastic intellectual property and patents that surround our queuing business and defend and protect our right to that market in a way that, you know, we have no competition, or at least I don't see any. And the market are all understand, when I say the market, I mean the operators, all understand that certainly in the vast majority of the world's, you know, serious theme park markets, we have those ideas protected. And so if they want to use technology to help them monetize queue lines, as opposed to, you know, stamping a stamp on the back of somebody's hand or giving them a wristband or a magic ticket or whatever it might be, a low-tech solution, then they probably need to be talking to us. So, but other than queuing, in our ticketing businesses, it's a really interesting phenomenon, which hadn't occurred to me until, you know, some close chat pointed it out a few months ago. And that is you get to a point where you tip into market leadership. And so what that means for us is, you know, we have one instance of our queuing platforms. They sit up on the cloud, so on Rackspace servers somewhere in Illinois or wherever they are. And every single customer uses the same software platform. Now, they'll look at it through a different lens, so it looks different. So clearly, a Merlin customer will see a different set of products and rules, and it'll be branded differently. So, but the core functionality driving, you know, our Merlin client site is the same as everybody else's. And so what happens is that over time, you know, we sat down, or Steve, my colleague and friend, sat down and with other colleagues, you know, specified a system that they thought was the very best, their very best solution to or product for a cloud ticketing product. And since then, every time we win a new customer, you know, they'll come with ideas about how it can be improved. And they'll say to us, you know what, XSO, we'd love it if your product could do the following. And they'll give us an idea. And we at that point go, yep, that's a brilliant idea. Let's go away and build it for you. And we build it. And we do that on our dollar. We don't charge for it. We do it on our dollar. And we give it back to them. We say, there's that functionality you asked for. And then we make it available to everybody else as well. So everybody benefits from everybody's ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an absolute, we're completely open and upfront about that with everybody. So all of our new clients are benefiting from the from the IP around, you know, us selling hundreds of millions of tickets, you know, in the past, just as all of their new ideas will come into our platform and again will enrich the platform that we have. And over time, and particularly as you get bigger and bigger and bigger, your product just gets better and better and better and better and better. And there comes a point when actually you become the kind of the industry repository for loads of great ideas from lots of brilliant operators. And at that point, you start to stretch away as a business from the competition. And yeah. I think this is a particular feature of cloud because, you know, we update our software every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks on a Tuesday morning, the guys go in the middle of a blinking night, poor things, and update our core stack. Test everything up and down, left and right. You know, run by every combination of every ticket on every website that we run, you know, for real, and update maybe 100 updates onto our into the software. So building in new features and functionality that our clients have requested, or things that we think will, you know, will be an improvement. And, you know, the cloud allows you to do that in a way that if you have a traditionally installed software product where they send out a CD once a year with a whole bunch of updates on it, you know, that model just can't keep up in terms of, you know, our clients' ability to respond and react to what's going on around them in their market. So anyway, we find ourselves in a good place with some great IP, you know, well defended by either market share or by just being a place where lots of good ideas have been built and are shared.
Yeah, okay, that sounds really positive. That leads quite well into some of the reader questions, actually, which are mostly about growth in your marketplace. So shall we launch into those?
You bet.
First question is from Greg. Well, he's asked two questions, so I'll do a follow-on. But the first question, he says, where do you see Accesso in 10 years' time?
Gosh. So we set out 3 years ago, our vision was to become, you know, the premier technology provider to the world's leisure and attractions and cultural markets. And, you know, I would be gutted if we weren't very obviously, at the very least, that. And I think in some market, on a global scale, and I would say in some markets, you know, where probably the preeminent provider of, you know, some of that already, but I would want to be, you know, whether you're a ski resort operator or whether you're run a water park or a museum or a theme park or, you know, a walk-through attraction where you might go for a couple of hours on a wet afternoon, an aquarium, whatever it might be, I'd like to be considered globally to be, you know, the people setting the pace.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I'd like to be.
So a very much larger business then, I would
guess. Very substantially larger, yeah, absolutely. Multi-billion would be my hope in 10 years.
Multi-billion? Yeah. What market cap?
Market cap, yeah.
Gosh, wow, exciting. And Greg's follow-on question, he asks, will Accesso be going after the likes of Ticketmaster, who I believe charge between 15 to 50% of the face value of tickets and service fees? Surely Accesso has the technology to do this and could undercut them, he asks.
Sure. So, yes, our assigned seat business, Showware, already works with some of the largest artists in the world selling tickets for their tours. You know, we were the first people ever to do ticketing on Facebook, for example. I think it was Bon Jovi. We sold out one of a Bon Jovi tour on Facebook. Okay. So, yeah, right now, today, we compete with Ticketmaster. In some markets, more capably than in others. You know, I don't want to, it would take me too long to explain, you know, the whole background to this, but Ticketmaster, in the good old days when, you know, I was a boy, Ticketmaster were, you know, their core function, it seemed to me at least as an observer, was as a promoter, effectively. You know, they understood lots of consumers, you know, preferences, and once a month or once a quarter or whatever it was, a catalogue would appear in the mail, and you flip through the catalogue and you go, oh, yeah, want to go and see that, and you phoned up a call centre and you gave them your credit card and they sent you some tickets. And, you know, for that, they charged, you know, to your reader's point, they charged a big old commission. And I think what's changed is that, well, key things have changed in the world over the last even 5 years, let alone 10 or 15. And the first one is that, first of all, consumers are now connected with their social lives and their friends and things that interest them in an entirely different way. Mm. So, you know, if you're a fan of a pop group, you know, there's, you know, so if I tell my daughter, for example, that I once slept on a pavement to get tickets for the Rolling Stones, you know, she looks at me like I've been beamed in from Mars, right? She's 15. She's spent quite a lot of time looking at me thinking I've been beamed in from Mars, to be fair. But this was on that instance, you know, she's, you know, if you think about how a teenager buys a ticket, it's got nothing to do with sleeping on pavements, I can assure you.
Nice.
And actually, I don't need Ticketmaster or anybody to tell me what's coming up.
Mm.
Because I'm on their Facebook page, or I've logged in on their website and they send me emails once a month, or my friends ping me on social media to say, you know, such and such are playing, should we get tickets? You know, so that communication layer, you know, consumers don't need to be pushed anymore because they're pulling from the market. They're pulling from things that interest them. And the second thing that's really changed, and I think which is changing the whole industry, is the way that artists get paid. So if you're a performer now, particularly a music, you know, live music, you don't get paid by selling records anymore. You know, when we were a boy, you know, you went up to the newsagents at the weekend and you bought a single for 99p or whatever it was. You know, that isn't how it works anymore, it turns out. And, you know, there's been plenty of stuff on the web about Taylor Swift, you know, being irritated by Apple Pay or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. Because that's not how they don't get rich on Apple Pay. You know, they get rich getting on tour and selling stuff. So, you know, if we have a platform which can help connect venues and artists and promoters and consumers at, you know, a much, much, much thinner margin than 20%, let's say, or 25%, you know, maybe we can do it for 1% or 2% and still make a fantastic gross margin doing that, then you can see which way, you know, which way the wind's blowing in terms of the way the consumers are changing their consumption, behavior of consumption, and the way that artists are being paid. So a long-winded answer to what was quite a straightforward question. We already compete with them. They've done a great job, Ticketmaster, and have done a great, as an example, have done a great job doing long-term deals with venues where, you know, if you're an artist and you want to go play at venue X, there's a long-term exclusive deal in place with Ticketmaster. But, you know, that's only a few venues. It's not all of them. And, you know, I can tell you, we ticketed some of the biggest names in the world around Brazil this summer. And, you know, we did it for a fraction of the price of a similar tour in North America. And it all seemed to go pretty well from where we were sitting.
Okay. So, but presumably, I'd imagine in that line of business, your market share would be relatively small at the moment.
Minute. We're not even touching the sides. We're not even a rounding error.
Okay. But you see great potential there, presumably.
But there's a massive market for it. Yeah, absolutely. The whole assigned seat world. You know, the only markets that I would say that, I say the only markets, the markets where I'd say we have best traction and where we are kind of have the biggest reputation. You know, certainly I think North American theme park and water park market, you know, we're a very significant vendor to that market and we are well known. Now, in Europe, however, and when I say that, you know, we might have as much as 35 or 40% of that market ticketing, for example. Mm. It's probably a little less than that. In Europe, it's certainly considerably less than 10%. It might be 5%, 6%. And in Asia, it's precisely 0%.
Is this for the theme park market you're talking about now?
Yeah, this is for general admission. You know,
and for
assigned seat ticketing, you know, it's certainly considerably less than 1% in North America, and zero in Europe and zero in Asia. So, you know, in terms of, you know, the scale of the opportunity, we're just getting rolling. We're not even close. The other market where we have some good presence is North American ski market. You know, through our Sirius colleague friends and colleagues at Siriusware, and you know, I don't know, maybe we've got 50% of the North American ski market, you know, ski resorts as customers, something like that. But, you know, masses of room to grow that business. And actually, it's growing very well in, you know, adjacent markets like the cultural market, some big museums. We've won a number of big museum clients over the last few months with Siriusware. We've just brought them to Europe for their first time they've been in Europe. And so we've installed Siriusware at our low-key customer, which is Blackpool Pleasure Beach, which are, you know, they're a big operation, Blackpool Pleasure Beach. They're a multi-million attendee attraction. And that's a fantastic reference for us now in Europe with the Siriusware product. So, you know, and again, we don't do it. We do a little bit in Australia with that product. But, you know, we've got so much scope to grow our company. It's eye-watering.
Okay. I think we've half answered the next question, really. But this one's from Kenobi. Mm-hmm. He says, given that you now have Merlin and are unlikely to get Disney, what are the prospects for group growth outside these two companies over the next few years?
Well, I would just refer you to my answer of the minister to
again. You've covered that, haven't you?
They're startlingly good.
You
know, if I think about the top 10 theme park operators, you know, we have, you know, what we find is that you know, trust counts for an enormous amount. Trust and reputation count for an enormous amount. And, you know, there's no substitute for winning a piece of work with a client, whether it's a trial or whether it's, you know, for, you know, a fairly some narrow piece of business that you're able to help them with, and just doing a great job and building the brand and building a reputation, you know, internally with an organization, and, you know, hopefully, you know, being able to, you know, communicate that you can do more than whatever it is, you know, that initial trial, the scope of that initial piece of business. So we're always really encouraged when we land a new client, excuse me, that we do a bit of work. And, you know, because from little acorns, you know, bigger things typically will grow, you know, if we're keeping our promises and doing a good job. So in terms of, if I think about sort of the top five or six North American groups, you know, we do a little bit of work with Universal. There's lots more I'd love to be able to help them with. We don't do anything at all at the moment with SeaWorld. You know, I'd love to work with SeaWorld. And you know, we have lots of friends working at SeaWorld, not least, you know, their new chief executive who was a friend of ours in his previous job at Hershey & Family Entertainment, who were clients. There's just two in North America. In Europe, you know, when we're in North America, we work a great deal with Parques Reunidos and their subsidiary, who are a bigger European group, who in North America have a water park business called Palace. We do all their ticketing in North America. You know, we'd love to do more work with them across Europe. I can think of three big Chinese operators, OCT and Chan Long and Diamond Wonder. We don't do any business with any of them. You know, so there's, in a way, we're even in our, what we would consider to be our, you know, sort of most established markets, there are, I think, an extraordinary opportunity to grow our business.
That's great. And I mean, another point, just more a point than a question, is that shareholders can verify how highly regarded your software is just by reading results from Merlin, for example, where they absolutely wax lyrical about Accesso and how it was going to help their business. So we've got great third-party confirmation of all the stuff that you're saying, really.
Yeah, well, thank you for mentioning that. You know, it's humbling when your client is, you know, enthusiastic about what you're doing for them. And, you know, clearly, you know, we work extremely hard, and it's a huge, you know, hats off to our team who are working incredibly hard to, you know, to serve Merlin and hopefully, you know, wow them and keep all the promises that, you know, we made. And, you know, so far so good. You're right. You know, they had their results out a couple of weeks ago, and they were very generous in their, you know, feedback on us. And, you know, and we have other clients who are the same. You know, over the years, you know, most of our big clients have been kind enough to, you know, say what a positive impact we have on their business. And, you know, I would hate that our clients think of us as being a supplier. And I know this sounds a little bit, you know, sort of hackneyed and, you know, marketing speak, but I really, really want them to think of us as being a partner. And as being somebody that's in there for the long term, investing hard for us both. You know, if we're doing a great job, it should be helping my operator customers, because they should be, let's hope, making more revenue, selling more stuff, you know, creating better guest experiences for their guests. And, you know, in turn, it's helping me too, because I'm taking a little bit of that. So, you know, I think our model, our commercial model, really supports that. It you know, our customers are as important to us on the last day of the contract as they are on the first, because we only get paid when we're doing stuff, when we're making things happen, and we get paid
aligned.
After we've done it. We don't get paid in advance. We don't send them a piece of software and say, you know, this is going to do great things for you, all the best of luck, chum, and then disappear. Absolutely not. We say, here it is, have it for free, and, you know, let's make money together. And it just creates a different alignment, you know, as you say. It's and when it goes well, and when everybody's, you know, engaged with that purpose and that common purpose, you know, my goodness, you get stuff done. It's fantastic.
That's good. Okay, next one, Ben asks about Asia. He says, I noticed your prelims made reference to an upcoming Asian rollout with Merlin. Does this remain your main strategy to get a foothold in this market? Are you able to expand on your plans?
Well, the short answer is yes. The slightly longer answer is, so there seem to me to be, you know, several routes to building out a business in Asia. And, you know, Asia is a big place, first thing to say. There's a lot of it. We do quite a lot of business in Australia already. We have low-key business in Siriusware business, you know, today running in Australia and in New Zealand, or Siriusware in New Zealand. So Australasia, we already have a foothold. But, you know, sort of more sort of what I suppose a British investor might think of as being, you know, more Asia, so China, Hong Kong, Singapore, Thailand, Indonesia, you know, that sort of more northern area. You know, there seem to me to be a number of potential ways to grow our business there. And ultimately, I think it comes down to, you know, no client wants to be the first. So what do I mean by that? What I mean is, you know, option one, I think, for us was probably to go out there, set up an office, you know, build out the software, do all the translations, make sure we could take payments in baht and in renminbi, and that our, you know, data center environment was all, you know, set up, and the data privacy, all the kind of the stuff you have to do. Make sure there's somebody on the end of the phone who's speaking the right language in the right time zone to be able to answer, you know, a question from a client when they've done something, you know, done something wrong, buying a ticket, all of that infrastructure. And really, it's a question of timing. You know, do you build out that infrastructure on the basis that you build this and they will come? Or do you build it out on the basis that, you know, you've got a customer broadly helping you pay for that because they're going live across a whole bunch of venues? And I think we decided to see if we could have our cake and eat it. So we partnered with somebody locally to see if, you know, a partnership relationship with somebody who was well-known in the region might help us, you know, start to build a presence and win some business. And the fact is that didn't really work terribly well. You know, people were very interested. We got lots and lots of meetings. We talked about the brand. We talked about the products. We talked about what we did. And lots of people were terribly interested. But actually getting them over the line to sign a contract when they couldn't see the software, you know, working and operating, they couldn't call up their pal and say, you know, you're using this, what do you think?
Yeah.
That became really challenging. So we decided just to bide our time. This was about a year ago, probably. We decided just to bide our time and just wait for one of our Western clients with Asian ambitions to take us. And so it has come to pass. So Merlin are the first one. I'm sure there will be others in the future, but Merlin are the first one who, as part of their rollout of their, you know, this global platform that we're doing for them, you know, clearly have, you know, a number and growing fast of attractions, you know, across Australasia and Asia. So, and in fact, if I think about the rollout schedule now, you know, we're off to Australia very shortly to get their Australian attractions, you know, onto Passport, and then, you know, 2017. The rest of 2016, we're spending with Merlin largely in Europe, rolling out their big European attractions. And in fact, we just went live at the London cluster, so the London Eye and the attractions on the South Bank and Madame Tussauds. We just went live there literally a couple of weeks ago. So if you go there to buy a ticket now, you'll see it's Accesso that's you know, running the store, managing the store. And we'll do the rest of Europe, or the majority of the rest of the Europe this year. And then we'll be in Asia proper, rolling out for 2017, and so, you know, lots of stuff has to happen in advance. Clearly, we're not the kind of company that, you know, has it ready for Friday so you can install it on the Monday morning. That's not how we roll. You know, we're already testing and running hot servers in data centers in Hong Kong. We're already, you know, hiring the people. We found somebody, I think, who's electric to run our business in Hong Kong. We're finding the office space. And a huge amount of work in the sort of the back office, the plumbing that makes all of our systems work is being done at the moment. And in fact, excitingly, I think we just saw an early Japanese website, you know, for something that we're doing there. And it's kind of exciting to see to see something that you're very familiar with in Japanese for the first time, let me tell you. And you hope the translation company has done the right job. And so anyway, Asia is coming. I think our strategy might have been different if we'd seen a competitive vendor emerge in Asia who we thought was a threat. And if that had happened, then I think that might have impacted our strategy. But you know, we don't see anybody there who's any different from the people that we routinely compete with everywhere else in the world and routinely displace everywhere else in the world. So
okay, I mean
I'm not too worried.
Okay, that brings us nicely to actually to you've answered two really questions there from Greg and from John indirectly, so with that, that's good. We can tick those off. But the question of competition is mentioned. One reader asks about AIM-listed Galasys, saying, do you see them as a competitive threat, or is there an opportunity to perhaps acquire them?
Well, you know, can I abstract that my comment, you know, one level up? And rather than talking specifically about Galasys, because I prefer not to talk about it about anybody in particular.
Yes.
But just in general, let me make some observations. First of all, you know, I have personally, and I don't trust anybody else to do this. I don't know how many companies I've visited and talked to, and you know, filtered as part of you know a potential acquisition journey that we've been on. But it's tens and tens and tens of companies. And I don't know how many flights I've taken, but it's literally hundreds in 5 years to find what we believe are the absolute best of breed potential acquisitions around the world. And I can assure you that we've lifted a lot of rocks and had a look at what's underneath. Mm-hmm. And again, not talking about any company in specific, because there are tens of companies that we've looked at. You know, there's a very, very, very short list of companies that we believe meet our requirements and we believe are the right fit for us. And it might be that their software's okay, but we just don't like the financials, or we don't like the management team style, or we don't like the culture, or whatever it might be. There are lots of reasons why you may or you may not want to buy something. But by and large, you know, we're pretty fussy. By and large, you know, we're looking for, you know, significant earnings accretion. We're looking for a really tight cultural fit. We're looking for something that, you know, is going to help us collectively accelerate. We're looking for something which is owned and run by the founders, typically. That's important to me. You know, I want the guy or the girl who had the oomph to start the business and turn it into 60 people and $10 million of revenue, just to pluck numbers, you know. But, you know, if in my simple brain, if you speak to an entrepreneur who's founded a business that's been successful, you know what? The business that he or she has built will very often be in his or her image. You know, you'll see their style, their personality, going through the business. So in terms of a diligence exercise, you know, clearly we pay you know BDO whoever it is to look over the numbers, and we have our lawyers go over the contracts, and you can do that until you're blue in the face. But actually, the personality of the business. You know, how do people react? What's likely to be the, you know, the moral compass of the business? You get that from the founder, or you can get that from a founder. So, you know, I have a massive preference to buying businesses from a founder where I know that the founder is buying into our collective story rather than cashing out of theirs. You know, for example, buying a business from private equity, you know, to me is, you know, fraught with risk. Because, you know, there's an angle, there's a reason. And it may be a good one, but it may be a bad one, that this business is on the blocks. And you can be sure that they'll have, you know, never buy a business that's for sale. That's a nice.
very good point.
Never buy a business for sale. None of the businesses we bought have been for sale. You know, absolutely not. I've called them out of the blue and said, hi, it's Tom, can I come and see you? And they've had the courtesy to say yes. Largely out of interest, I imagine, just think what the heck is this lunatic flying around the world to see me for. And so to answer your question, we feel that we are in a pretty unique spot on a number of levels. We have a business which is growing hard, making good money, where we have fantastic forward revenue visibility because we've got this extraordinarily high-quality revenue model where we have, you know, very defensible IP, either because it's patented or because we just, you know, have huge, huge kind of industry IP collected in our software systems in a way which is incredibly hard to replicate if you don't have a cloud-based product. And, you know, as I look at the universe of the potential things to go and buy, you know, I think that I've got the best ones. And I think that it would be very easy to go and buy another three or four, which might meet some of the criteria that I've just described to you, but actually wouldn't meet all of them. And yeah. I think we will be better served, and our shareholders, importantly, will be better served by us internationalizing the products we have today rather than trying to go and buy a customer base from somebody else.
Yeah, I see.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does complete. We'd probably better try and speed up a bit, Tom, as we're running out of time.
No,
it's all interesting stuff, so I'm happy to let you talk. But I'm going to skip over three questions on growth and markets because I think we've kind of obliquely covered, we've covered that area pretty thoroughly, haven't we?
So
jumping ahead to Martin's question, he asks about licensing. He says, in October 2015, you issued an RNS talking about a licensing campaign with Dominion Harbour Group. Could you remind us what that's about and how it's progressing, perhaps?
Sure. So in a paragraph, Dominion Harbour are helping us explore the possibility that, you know, there may be infringers around of some of our queuing reservation kind of led IP. This is where companies, you know, probably, you know, unwittingly, are relying on IP that we have patented with a view that where we believe that is the case, we enter into some kind of license arrangement with those companies to pay us for the privilege of borrowing our IP. And Dominion Harbour are helping us coordinate that program. They're specialists in doing exactly that. We're doing the program is being run on a sort of contingent basis. So, you know, if, you know, heaven forbid, we have to end up suing somebody or taking somebody to court to say, come on, you know, you really are in breach of this and they tell us to get lost and we have to go to court, then, you know, we're doing it on a kind of on a contingent basis. So, you know, the others, you know, the lawyers will cover their own costs on the basis of, a revenue share arrangement with us on anything where any kind of license we're able to recover. So at the moment, you know, that scheme is off and running. These, you know, big wheels turn slow. But as and when I've got things to update the market with, I will definitely come back and tell people.
Okay, brilliant. Actually, that leads on to Keith's question, which is about patents. Mm-hmm. He said, is your technology protected by patents and does this create opportunities for licensing, which we've just touched on, haven't we? So
I'd go in yes and no. Queuing, absolutely. Ticketing, much more difficult. But there's other ways to build moats around your business which, you know, aren't just patents.
Yes. So it's know-how, I suppose, as well as just patents.
Massively. Yeah. Mm. And having a platform where you become the place where all the good ideas hang out, as I've described, with our ticketing platform.
Okay. So the patents you have got then, how much longer have they got to expire and will that sort of impact things?
We've got 45, I think, current patents, and some of them have got 20 years to run, some of them have got 2 years to run, and everything in between. So I would say that our opportunity to challenge other businesses in non-theme park markets, they're the first patents to run out, are the very broadest patents, which aren't necessarily sort of theme park specific. If that makes sense. You know, to get a patent, you have to demonstrate that you have a novel idea that no one else has ever had. So when Len, our founder, sat down and thought about virtual queuing for the first time, you know, he had a pretty, you know, green field on which he could go out and stake out his ideas. And some of the ideas he staked out and others staked out at the time were very broad and went across multiple markets. You know, as those ideas start being had, you have to start refining the novelty, because, you know, it becomes harder to find things which are novel and therefore patentable. So in answer to your question, you know, I think our core queuing franchise is well protected for, you know, many years to come. I think, you know, our ability to, you know, maybe look for licensing recoveries from other markets, you know, starts to ebb away, you know, sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Okay. So it's icing on the cake, really, if we get some licensing.
It's a moonshot. If it happens, yeah. Happy days. It's not a trading fundamental. I wouldn't recommend that anybody buys shares on the basis of it. But
no,
if it comes, it comes in, it might be jolly nice. Thank you very much.
Okay, excellent. Just two final questions, really, on sort of finance and accounting issues. Craig has asked, when will it be the right time to start paying dividends?
Well, the sooner the better, speaking as a shareholder. I say that glibly. You know what? I think here's what I think about dividends. I think that, you know, whilst we have, and we've used the same expression, I think, pretty much in every set of results that we've issued, whilst we've got a better use for the cash, we'll continue to spend it on acquisition and on products and all the other things that we can spend it on. And in terms of, you know, absolute returns to our investors, you know, in the 5 years that I've been chief exec, our share price has gone from 80p to, you know, touching 10 quid. And, you know, clearly I could have paid a dividend on the way. We make money every year, but actually we think that money is better reinvested in our company. So, you know, for the time being, you know, I can't see a time when I'm paying a dividend, but I would hasten the day. You know, the sooner as we can, we will, because we're all shareholders. But right now, I think everybody's better off if we don't.
I agree.
You know, and it's as simple as that. I think, you know, once you're on the dividend strategy, very hard to get off it. And the last thing I want to do is, you know, set an expectation with a shareholder that we're going to be paying a dividend, and then for some reason have a brilliant alternative use for, you know, something, and say, well, actually, hang on, this year we're not going to. You know, you can't do that. My view is it's much better just to be upfront and say, no, that's not how we're going to return your money to you. You know, you might, you know, if you want to take some earnings out, you know, with any luck, the share price has doubled since you bought the shares, and you can, you know, you can get some upside from that, from that. And that's good too, because that just gives other people the opportunity to buy in. So, you know, okay. That's our view about dividends.
Yeah, that makes sense. And last question's just on capitalising R&D. Paul asks, is it not the case that profits are flattered by capitalising R&D expenditure?
Well, you know, I think, you know, everybody's got a different view on this particular subject, and some very close-held and some less close-held. You know, the way I think I'd probably put it to you is like this. I'd say that, you know, at our stage in the cycle, you know, we're investing very heavily in advance of revenues in some cases. You know, Merlin's a great example of that. And, you know, the earnings presented, you know, clearly will benefit if all the costs were written off, you know, versus if all the costs were written off in a year. So, yes, at some level, capitalizing R&D can flatter a result. That said, you know, there's an accounting standard in place for a reason. And we believe it allows investors to kind of probably more clearly understand underlying earnings and what's going on in the business. So what we try and do is we try and make sure that, you know, we and the analysts who kind of follow us, you know, generally have enough information to allow investors to rework the earnings numbers, you know, to exclude that capitalization if they wish. So, you know, I think as sort of emotionally, you know, we're not the kind of company that goes to look to capitalize absolutely everything that we can. That doesn't seem to be the right way to do it. But there's an accounting standard out there which gives us some guidance, and we'll work to that, and we'll tell you what we've done, and you can make up your own decision based on that. You know, and we have some analysts that will strip that out. You know, I'm thinking of, you know, the new miss guys, and David Toms, who's, you know, he routinely just reverses out R&D, you know, and others that have a different approach. So I think just give people the information, and they can treat it as they will.
Yes. Okay. Brilliant. Well, that's a really comprehensive interview, Tom. Thanks ever so much for your time. Really appreciate it. We've covered sort of either directly or indirectly all the questions from readers. So really over to you for any sort of closing remarks that you want to make, or any points you'd like to cover that we haven't touched on yet.
Okay. Well, I think when we sat down 5 years ago with this little low-key queuing business, and we were thinking about the strategy. In fact, our broker, one of our senior advisors who was at that meeting, I had dinner with him just last night, and we were reflecting on that meeting. It was in the Leander Club in Henley. We rented a room there because our offices were in our only offices in Henley at that point. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think if we projected forward what we've achieved over what we thought was the market opportunity from 5 years ago, you know, I'd have certainly taken the outcome that I see today as, you know, in what we've been able to create, the businesses we've been able to, you know, encourage to join us on our journey and to acquire. And what I feel now is that, you know, we have most of the parts and pieces assembled for our business, and now it's how do we execute against the enormous opportunity that we see. And I think we have the raw materials. I think we have fantastic assets available to us. I think we have a strong brand. I think we have a very supportive shareholder base who I haven't ever really asked for very much, I have to say. I've never placed a share in the public market to raise money, ever. And I can tell you there's lots of people would like me to. So we have a lot of positives lining up. And I think our challenge now is to make sure that as we project for the next 5 years, and I can't wait to see where we end up in 5 years, you know, that we take advantage of that opportunity, but that it feels like we're just tipping over into a company that's taken seriously by some of the biggest brands in our ecosystem, in our world, and trusted as a long-term partner. And that actually, once you're into that space, once you'll be considered in that company, you can have similar conversations with others, I think, you know, with a straight face and knowing that you can deliver it and knowing in your heart that you can do a great job for people. And it feels like we're just moving into that space, and that's incredibly exciting. And I know, you know, I've got 300 plus people behind me all lined up thinking the same thing. And we're excited about what that means for all of us. It's going to be a hoot, apart from anything else.
Brilliant. Well, that sounds tremendously exciting, Tom. And thank you very much indeed for the share price appreciation to date. I bought on it's the morning pleasure. Of the Merlin deal. I thought to myself, this is transformational. I bought and almost doubled my money already. So thank you very much indeed.
Well, clearly I can't guarantee it's going to double again, and you know, in the next 6 months. But you know, you can be sure that we'll be working bloody hard to do whatever we can to get to you know, do the best we can, and hopefully the market will recognise that.
Yeah, oh, that's brilliant. Well, thanks ever so much, Tom. I really enjoyed talking to you. I've learned a lot. So hopefully speak again at some point in the future.
Any time that's helpful, of course.
Smashing. Thanks, Tom.
All right. Cheers, Paul.
Cheers now.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.